Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down.
Hello, and welcome to Honesty Without Fear, the Whistleblowers Radio Hour. I'm Steve Cohn, your host for today. Honesty Without Fear is not just talk radio. We are here to make change. And we encourage you to call any questions or comments at 1-888-874-4888. Or submit your questions online at whistleblowersradio.org or tweet them at PRN_radio. During the first half hour of the show, I will be talking with Donna Bowen, the principal at Compliance Strategists LLC, an internationally recognized authority on compliance, ethics, and organizational governance. Donna is the former chief compliance officer at two leading multinational corporations. She's one of the most respected experts on corporate compliance and how those programs are essential in combating fraud and increasing ethical behavior. We'll be discussing the first 6 months of the newly enacted Dodd-Frank corporate fraud law. It's a highly controversial law. We think it's one of the most important whistleblower laws ever passed, and we'll hear Donna's take. We will also be talking about a brief recently filed by the General Electric Company arguing that employees who contact their internal compliance programs can be fired and lose whistleblower rights if they report internally. During the second half of the show, I will interview FBI whistleblower Sybelle Edmonds about her current battle against the FBI. The FBI has spent enormous resources trying to prevent Ms. Edmonds from publishing her book, Classified Woman, The Sybelle Edmonds Story. In that book, she wants to talk and tell the story about serious security breaches and cover-ups she witnessed while working for the FBI. But the FBI is refusing to give clearance, and as we'll explain on the show, is seriously violating the law and the Constitution in trying to suppress her speech. But now let's start with Donna. Donna, are you on the line? Donna, are you here with us?
Yes, I am.
Great. And it's an honor and a pleasure to have you, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Donna, can you give our listeners just a little bit of your resume and background as to your expertise in corporate compliance programs?
Yes. Well, just in a nutshell, I've been the chief compliance officer and the founder of two corporate compliance programs. First, the BOC Group, which is now a part of the Linde Group, UK corporation, and second, with BP, British Petroleum, PLC, out of London, and I founded the programs for both of those companies.
And also, I know you go back in terms of the history of corporate compliance and building organizations and building a credibility for these programs. Can you just tell us, you know, where the country was at when you started in compliance and how that has developed over the years?
Right. Well, I started out, as you know, as a corporate lawyer on Wall Street, and at the time, the country had just passed the federal sentencing guidelines in 1991 was when I first went in-house to work in-house at my first company where I founded the compliance program, and I was a corporate lawyer. I asked to take on the compliance program, which people were just struggling to figure out what these new federal sentencing guidelines meant for corporations. And so that was really the birth, the push. Not that there were not internal control programs before that, but this really gave the push for companies to take a much more serious approach to how they manage their legal and ethical risk, and I was there really at the beginning and given this task. So that was where the company, where the country really was when companies were trying to wrestle with this, and has really spent the last 20 years with developing, in many cases, robust structures and activities, personnel, to try and manage their corporate compliance. And I think there's been a lot of progress. I think there's a lot to go, a lot more progress to be made before we are there, but there has been a lot of progress.
And I just want to let our listeners know that I've known Donna for some time, and I've spoken at many conferences where she's invited me, and we've also went together and spoke to various SEC commissioners when they were putting together and debating the Dodd-Frank Act and the rules. And compliance departments in this country are literally on the front line of whistleblowing, because they're often the people the whistleblowers go to first. How they're treated can be essential, whether you're going to have accountability or real fraud detection, or whether people are going to become discouraged and retaliated against. The statistics show that most whistleblowers won't go to the government, that they'll really just go to these compliance departments. So whether the compliance departments work and work effectively is really critical for protecting investors, protecting the environment, and ensuring that laws are followed. So that said, we know that the Dodd-Frank Act was passed and was highly controversial because it gives rewards to whistleblowers who go to the Securities and Exchange Commission and expose violations of the Securities Exchange Act. So as part of the debate over that law and the rules, the Chamber of Commerce, among others, strongly supported a rule that would have required all employees to go internal to their compliance departments first, and would have excluded whistleblower protections if you didn't go to compliance in terms of eligibility for a reward. Now these rules have been in effect for 6 months. The law has been in effect for almost a year, actually over a year. And Donna, I know you're on the forefront of talking to compliance officials and monitoring this. What are your takeaways for how the Dodd-Frank Act has been moving forward and its impact on compliance programs?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, as you know, and you just mentioned, there was a very enormous controversy about whether the inside whistleblower should be required to report internally first. And National Whistleblower Center argued, and I think they were right, that that should not be a requirement. You may as well gut the whistleblower law if that's what you write into it. What's interesting is that we've been able to look now at, say, the first 7 full months of operation and see the results. So far, now it's just 6 or 7 months, but my takeaways are that for a number of reasons, and we've got a couple of surveys now and some numbers from Sean McKessie, who runs the whistleblower program, it appears that those concerns that if whistleblowers could go directly to the SEC, they would run in a stampede to the SEC, and this would undermine all of the efforts for corporate compliance programs to date. It appears that those concerns were overblown. And the column that I wrote on this was, which is posted on the NWC site, is "The Sky Has Not Yet Fallen."
And that's right. And that column's available at whistleblowerprotectionblog.org. And "The Sky Did Not Fall." And again, the Chamber of Commerce, among others, alleged that if employees could get monetary rewards, they would ignore these programs and ignore internal compliance. And so what I understand, Donna, that the facts just didn't bear that out.
Well, there are a couple of things that we can look at. One is, in Sean McKessie's own words, he has said publicly that he would be hard-pressed to name a case where the internal whistleblower of a true insider whistleblower tip did not report to someone else first before coming to the SEC. And that's really interesting because that bears out the study that the NWC submitted to the SEC at the time we were talking about these rules that said in the history of Key Tam, that was the same conclusion. Nearly 90% of the people who were coming to the government had tried 1, 2, 3, 11 times to report internally, and they were retaliated against, ignored, fired, or even worse. And so this does bear out. That is one clue we can look at, the numbers. There are also just... The other day, a BDO network survey came out that said fraud tips have hit an all-time high, that actually the number of internal tips, internal fraud tips, has increased for 4Q 2011 by 15.2% over the fourth quarter in 2010. So a total of 21.6% of the tips are internal fraud, and that would appear underscore the fact that these internal whistleblowers are not going and running directly to the government. They are trying to report internally. So it is very, very important, as you said, Steve, how we treat these internal whistleblowers when they come forward, and how we manage that. And companies who are concerned about the external whistleblowing to the SEC should really be looking within as to how they are putting action and support and the right kind of culture into their programs.
Donna, now, based in, from your perspective, and I know you're very much tied into the compliance community and how corporations are responding to the Dodd-Frank Act, what's your perception of how companies are adjusting or changing, if at all, to these new laws and rules that truly empower employees to blow the whistle, and if their internal compliance programs do not work, unquestionably will encourage them to go to the Securities Exchange Commission to file fraud charges? What's the changes you've seen? And you can give me majority, minority, just your perception on how the corporate community is reacting.
Well, I would say the majority, the great majority of the corporate community has not made many changes in their corporate compliance programs, which is disappointing to me because you know that I have spoken written that this is a huge opportunity for companies to really look within and become much more serious about how they protect internal whistleblowers and encourage internal whistleblowers, and to not merely tolerate them, but to embrace them and view them as an asset. Because at the end of the day, companies want to hear about these things internally, you would think. And I was disappointed to see, but not terribly surprised, that the majority, there have been a couple of surveys, the majority of companies have not made any big changes. The changes that I have seen might be more in the manner of communicating about an internal line, more marketing, are really more superficial. Some of the more concerning changes I've seen are some, I wouldn't say majority, but some in the minority who I think have reacted poorly and have more of a siege mentality. We have to figure out how to deal with whistleblowers before they become whistleblowers and how to make sure we protect ourselves, which is the opposite of what I had hoped. So the minority of the companies that have created a siege mentality, I think, are reacting incorrectly, and they do so at their peril because they're going to send their employees straight to the government. Those that are ramping up their communication, are going along the right lines, but I think they need to go deeper and really look at culture, really look at how they are driving the behavior of their managers, their line management, and get more understanding on the part of their HR and legal with their compliance officer about how to respond in a positive way. And I'm not seeing that being delivered yet.
No.
I don't think it will until the big cases start coming out.
Now, what type of, in other words, if I was a whistleblower and I was working in a company and I wanted to figure out, should I go to my compliance department, you know, call the hotline, or should I go totally undercover, tell no one in the company, go anonymous, and go straight to the SEC? If I was trying to make that decision, what types of features should I look at in my company's compliance department to try to get to be able to judge it as to whether it will be superficial or whether it will be a program that has integrity and one that I could trust or work with?
The single most important feature that I would look for and that I would suggest to any family member that were thinking about reporting something they were worried about or concerned about would be the independence of the chief compliance officer and the function. And there are many indicia of that. One clear indicia is the reporting line. If that compliance officer reports directly to the CEO with unfiltered access to the board, then I would say there is independence. But if that chief compliance officer does not report in that manner, reports somehow through legal, does not have an independent budget, I would have more concern.
And in terms of reporting to legal, you know, I'm an attorney. I know you're an attorney.
Right.
It just strikes me that legal, for any company, has an inherent conflict of interest. Are they trying to uncover wrongdoing and get to the bottom? Or are they the lawyers for the company to defend wrongdoing or try to minimize its impact? It just strikes me that legal is the worst place for a compliance program to report to and just has so many inherent conflicts. What's your take on that?
That is generally my take. I think it is a difficult reporting arrangement for compliance to work through legal because, as you pointed out, legal has a very different mandate than compliance. And very often these mandates are compatible, but one of the areas in which they split are where compliance and ethics wants to hear the internal reports, wants to get to the bottom of it, wants to protect the whistleblower and find out the problems before those problems explode outside. And legal has a different mandate. Their mandate is to protect the company, to defend the company, to advise the company. And very often, if legal is the ultimate arbiter, their first instinct might be, isn't always, but might be, to suppress the whistleblower.
Now, going down to legal now, we have posted on the website of whistleblowersradio.org. So if anyone comes to that right now, and I'd recommend if you're listening, if you can get online and go to the website, we have posted a brief that was recently submitted in federal court by the General Electric Company. So if you come to whistleblowersradio.org and talk to the show for April 10, 2012, there'll be a line that says Arguments by General Electric. If you click that, the brief will appear. What's incredible about this brief is that General Electric went to the Securities Exchange Commission and argued forcibly that they should require every employee to go to their internal compliance program, ombudsman, supervisors, etc. And if they didn't do that, they would lose
the right to get a whistleblower reward and protections. Then the Dodd-Frank rules are enacted, and General Electric goes to federal court and argues the exact opposite. If you look at this, if you've opened up their brief, and if you go to page, and it's right on the website, you can just easily turn to it. If you look at the very top, you'll see page numbers from the federal court filing, and you go to page 9. And on page 9, look what they say. It's page 9 on the top. It's actually the brief, page 4. They say, this is about a whistleblower. They said that his complaint suffered a fundamental defect because he did not go to the SEC. They actually come right out and say that because he went to the company's ombudsman and the company's supervisor, GE's own words, he is not a whistleblower. And GE has gone into court and said that this employee who raised concerns with the ombudsman and supervisor can be fired, blacklisted, has no rights because he didn't contact the SEC. So, Donna, I mean, I know actually you were the first person to call my attention to this, and I know you've blogged on it, but I would like to hear your opinion on when a company, be it GE or any other company, goes into court and says, we want to make legal precedent, law, that says to be a real whistleblower, you have to go to the government, and if you use these compliance programs, you can be fired. Well, what's your take on that?
Well, I think it's really counterproductive to the ultimate goal that companies have. And ultimately what companies want is for employees to feel safe in coming forward to raise concerns as an asset, as a trusted employee to the company, to raise their hand and say, this is something I saw and I'm concerned about it. I want to raise it to management. All companies that have compliance programs say in their documents, say in their codes, say in their posters that this is what they want. Please come forward. And we all know that unless we create an atmosphere of genuine safety where employees feel that management means what it says about this, and they look around their workplace and they see what happens. They know what happens to people who raise concerns. And unless they see that they can do so safely, these things are always going to be pushed underground. So I'm finding a real disconnect for companies to take that position, because if they want people to come forward, then those people should be protected.
And I just found it so hypocritical that they would argue before the SEC that you should require the employee to go internal and then argue in federal court that you can fire people who go internally. And I also came to the conclusion that such an argument would be devastating. I mean, why would anybody use GE's internal compliance program if GE as a corporation is saying you can be fired? So my question, Donna, is what can compliance professionals do to try to ensure that these type of arguments aren't raised and that companies actually become committed to these very important programs?
The way that companies react to whistleblowers, to me, is the ultimate barometer of the culture of the company. I mean, you can have lots of other bells and whistles, but where rubber meets the road is, what do they do? How do they react to people who raise concerns? And when I evaluate companies, it's one of the first things I look at. Those companies that really want to create compliance programs at work, and this is the heart of the compliance program, they need to change their thinking and their culture about how they treat whistleblowers. And the only way to do that is to also change the way that we incentivize and reward and evaluate all of our line management all the way up to the executives. Because they have to show ethical leadership. They have to understand what their duties are and how they need to react, because human nature being what it is, the first human reaction to someone that raises a concern is not going to be good. This is not something that comes automatically. And so I think until companies really change that culture, we are not going to have compliance programs that really work.
Well, Don, I want to thank you for those words of wisdom, and thank you so much for being on the show. Do you have a website for your compliance organization?
Yes, thank you. It's www.compliancestrategist.com.
And I want to say that Don is one of the leading experts and professionals on compliance in the entire world. She's spoken to the Parliament, the House of Lords. She, and I'm honored that you were able to make the show. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Steve.
And I want to thank you for listening. We have to go on a promotional break right now, but please stay tuned. After the break, I will talk to Sybelle Edmonds about her battle to publish her new book, Classified Woman, The Sybelle Edmonds Story. Thank you for listening.
Down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down.
Welcome back to Honesty Without Fear. My name is Steve Cohn. I'm the host for today's program, and I am honored and pleased to have Sybelle Edmonds with me to discuss her struggles to publish her new book, Classified Woman, The Sybelle Edmonds Story. In this book, Sybelle is attempting to discuss her experiences as an FBI language specialist who discovered and blew the whistle on serious security concerns and cover-ups at the FBI. The FBI fired her when she raised these concerns, and I know it well because I was involved in the case and know directly that the FBI wanted her out and wanted her silenced. For making these disclosures, Sybelle was one of the first victims of the Bush administration's aggressive state's secret program where they would try to throw people's cases out of court by raising this doctrine of a state secret and claiming that they could not discuss their concerns. In fact, Sybelle was the first whistleblower case that I was personally involved in or aware of where this was invoked. But despite the state secret's privilege, the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Inspector General conducted a full investigation, published a lengthy report, and documented not only that Sybelle was the victim of retaliation, but that the concerns she raised were critical for our nation's safety. I had a full discussion. So on the one hand, the Inspector General published this report, and on the other hand, the Attorney General went into court and said she has no rights because of state secrets. Well, her case received widespread notoriety. She received the very prestigious First Amendment Award from the Pan American Center and Newman's Own. And her case really became a symbol of the government misusing the law and its power to suppress whistleblowers. Sybelle, it's an honor to have you on. Hello.
Thank you for having me on, Steve.
And what's going on right now in your case, just to explain to the listeners, there's a policy, a rule, that says that if you worked for a security organization like the FBI, the government can read what you want to write before it's published. It's called prior review, and has the authority to delete information that might be classified or secret. Now, this power of prior review was hated by our founding fathers and is extremely narrow. It's one of the most offensive procedures for the First Amendment. But if you work for the FBI like Sybelle did, you're required to submit your whistleblowing, your disclosures, your publication to the government for review before it's released. So, Sybelle, I want to just talk to you briefly. Can you just describe to us
when you worked for the FBI and what you're legally allowed to say about what you observed and the concerns that you had. And I want you to be careful to make sure that what you say contains no classified information and anything you say is already clearly in the public record. And I want to say I'm making this disclaimer because our government has been using both the clearance rules, the Espionage Act, and other laws to try to intimidate whistleblowers from raising any concerns. And it's having a real effect. People are afraid. So I want you to be very careful, Sabelle, when you speak, and make sure that everything you say, it can be fully documented, that it's in the public domain.
Yes, Steve. Well, my case involved several critical areas. Part of it had to do directly with 9/11. The other part dealt with an espionage case that was, in fact, confirmed both by the IG and the Congress, and also other internal cover-up and security breach incidents. And in this manuscript, what I did, knowing my own case inside and out, and also having fought this case for 10 years, knowing what is classified, what is not classified, you know, for example, things such as methods of intelligence gathering or informants, I made sure that I wrote a manuscript that contained all the facts minus anything that is classified. And I could put a lot of things in this manuscript based on public documents. You know, as you're aware, I had all these tons of court documents that we filed with courts. They are not classified. We, of course, had the Inspector General's report. There has been hundreds of articles by investigative reporters who had interviewed people within the Justice Department and the FBI and Congress. So I had tons of open source information, public information. So I prepared this manuscript, and I basically complied with the Justice Department's laws with pre-publication reviews and submitted this work to the FBI, DOJ, in April. It was actually on April 26, 2011. And knowing that the FBI and the Justice Department, they had 30 working days to go over this manuscript, check it, and if they came across anything, which I knew there was nothing in there for them to come across, just black it out, return it to me at the end of that 30 business days, and I would just proceed with publication. I was planning to have this published. By now, I thought this book would have been out. But, as you know, because thanks to you and the National Whistleblower Center, and with your support and with your expertise explaining all the laws and the procedures to me, actually I dared going forward even with this book, knowing that all the stuff I had been through, I really did not have the stomach to go through another round of publication and pre-publication review with the FBI. I submitted it. I waited my 30 business days, and we did not get anything.
And now I just want to state for our listeners, I'm an attorney, and I've been working with Sabelle and representing her on trying to have this manuscript go through the process lawfully. And on our website, if you go to whistleblowersradio.org, we have now posted some of the letters that were sent. So if you go to whistleblowersradio.org for the entry for April 10, 2012, if you look, it says read the press release and for more information. If you just click that, the press release we issued today will come up. And then if you go down and you'll see on the fourth paragraph where it says documentation, just click that. And here you will see her employment agreement, which sets out the rule that she was supposed to follow. And if we look at it, and if you go to the second page, it says page 31 of 34, it says she is to give the director of the FBI at least 30 days prior to the disclosure. In other words, you submit it to the director, and he has up to 30 days to review it and approve it. We did
Absolutely.
That, as Sabelle said, and they didn't comply with this rule. But let me show you something else on this, and I want to talk to Sabella about it, which is, I think, highly inappropriate, illegal, and unconstitutional. If you go down on this very paragraph, and they talk about what is the power, what type of censorship will the FBI undergo, and look what it says here, that this censorship is intended to prevent disclosure of information where the disclosure would be contrary to law. I don't think anyone disagrees with that. Regulation, well, what does that mean? But here's the big one. Or public policy. The FBI and the government of the United States had Sabella Edmonds and probably countless other thousands of FBI employees and contractors sign an agreement to have their documentation censored if the FBI director thinks it's counter to public policy. This is illegal because there's numerous court cases that say the pre-publication can only be used for secret and classified information. Because it's such an abusive process, it's such an affront to the First Amendment, it has to be limited. Yet here, they're telling all their employees and contractors that they can undergo censorship for public policy, meaning cover-up of mistakes and embarrassing information at the FBI. Sabelle, my question for you is as someone who is a whistleblower, who has information they want to release, concerns they want the American people to know about, what was your reaction when, in looking at this and seeing that the FBI director could censor you if they think what you're saying is counter to public policy?
Well, my first emotional reaction was a sense of deja vu, because this basically brought back the memories of living in third world countries under monarchy or military dictatorship. And then my second more intellectual response was, first of all, this being illegal against the Constitution and as you know, we're against the separation of powers, also makes the contracts between the FBI, DOJ, and all their employees moot. Because they have signed, we have signed, they made me sign an illegal contract. Now, interestingly, and this will be addressed in the book, when I was signing my documents with the FBI, they had cited all sorts of things without any explanations or books or any kind of a directory telling people what it is actually they are signing. And I brought it up during signing, and they said, oh, this is the FBI, and people take their word for it. I mean, you are not siding with some company. This is the FBI. We are the law. And a lot of people, I'm sure, just like me, I was really naive, because when you're presented with tons and tons of papers, they just go and sign, and not knowing that they have signed a document that is illegal and unconstitutional. So I am going to be very anxiously waiting for Congress to take a step and do something about this. And I don't know what they are going to do with the current employees. I guess they all have to re-sign their agreements with the FBI because their current contract is unconstitutional and illegal.
And I would agree, Sabelle, I think your analysis is spot on. The law is clear. Pre-publication review. It's censorship. It's old-fashioned censorship. In other words, where the government says, you have to give me what you're going to write, your book, your article, your speech, and let me read it. And I, as the government, can take out my black magic marker and censor you and prohibit you from informing the American people about anything that I think I don't want them to learn about. So when these issues came up in court, because this power is so counter to the First Amendment, the courts put on very strict restrictions. And they said, okay, they can do this, but if it's classified or secret, and limited the government's ability. But this contract that Sabelle signed, that we found through our Freedom of Information and court documents, And that was clearly, it's just the standard form that thousands of people have signed will have a chilling effect on other employees who want to blow the whistle or report misconduct. And now they think that the FBI director can censor them if they disagree with the policy implications. I mean, this is not what the Constitution of the United States holds. Now, Sibel, you, as I understand it, you worked through all of the procedures required under the pre-publication process. It was appealed, we waited extra time, et cetera, correct?
Absolutely. In fact, actually, we went overboard with complying with all these rules. We went, as you said, to the appeal board. And as you know, Steve, the 30 working days is absolute. And again, there are court documents saying that that's absolute. It's not a wishy-washy number. That rule is 30 days, but it can also be 45 days. It's absolute. So we had 30 days. They had 30 days, yet here today it has been 343 days, and the FBI and DOJ, they are still holding this book, this manuscript, hostage.
Exactly.
And now, they are saying that we are not releasing any of it, not a single word.
Yeah, it's incredible. Now, the other thing I'd like to call our readers, if you go back to that press release on the website and go down to the next link, documentation, and if you click that, you will see a letter that I received as Sibel Edmonds' attorney just on February 7, 2012. This letter is very revealing for a number of factors. First, it says that the manuscript sent to our office on April 26, 2011. That's when this manuscript was submitted to the Bureau, and they've had more time than the law, more appeals, more everything. I'll tell you right now, these CFR sites you see here, the legal sites, everything was complied with. But look how the FBI, what they say in this letter. It says this, and I found this to be pretty, pretty amazing. It says, the matters Ms. Edmonds writes about involve many equities. Hold it right there. They shouldn't be reading this book about the equities of what she writes. She has the right under the Constitution as an American citizen to blow the whistles. Then they say, some of which may implicate information that is classified. Hold it right there. The law says you're to read it without any view of content, without any view of policy, without any view, any issue of the viewpoint of the author, and only censor materials that are classified. By their own words, they have moved beyond that. And clearly this is part of the reason why there's been such a delay in the approval of the publication. Sibel, is the material, I mean, can you just afford to sit back and wait for the Bureau to, you know, approve this if it takes 10 years? Or is there information that you want to blow the whistle on that you think the American people need to know before the next election?
Absolutely. And this is why I submitted this manuscript in April 2011, planning to have this book out, in fact, actually a few months ago, by last October, November, because it is extremely important to put this information out for the American people, also the Congress, and again, I said, okay, 30 business days, and then I'm proceeding with publication, and they haven't. They have basically held the entire book as hostage.
Now, Sibel, you've been a whistleblower for many years, and I know many people respect and admire what you've done, the courage you've shown, right from when you first blew the whistle internally at the FBI, all the way through your courage to take it to Congress, to the courts, to challenge state secrets, and now trying to actually tell your story to the American people despite the FBI's violations. But can you just give our listeners a little insight to, like, what is it like to be a whistleblower? What is it like to know information and have the your own government retaliating against you, pressuring you to be quiet? What's that like?
Well, as I said before, it brought back the memories of my childhood and my teenage years living in countries, several countries, under monarchy or military dictatorship. And it shattered my faith in Congress because I ended up having firsthand experience of Congress's inaction. And knowing that actually today, I know it for sure, that there is no such a thing as oversight, period. And that basically makes our Congress moot. If they don't exercise the oversight of these executive branches, they basically don't have any reason to exist. Right now, their reason to exist that they have given themselves, what they are practicing, is handing out money to these agencies that are, in return, they are butchering our Constitution and violating our rights. So it shattered my faith completely, 100% in Congress. But on the other hand, the alarming nature of it was we are supposed to be governed under the Constitution. It hasn't been happening, as you know, Steve. And the Constitution overrides anything else. They did not make the Constitution conditional, the Founding Fathers. They didn't say the Constitution holds true during the peacetime, but during any type of wartime, we put it on hold so it won't be valid. Or if there is any terrorism incident, then the Constitution will be placed in hold. Constitution is and its power and what it's supposed to be doing has been absolute, but what the government has been doing, and especially since 9/11, they have been saying that Constitution is irrelevant and that we will make exception to the First Amendment, to the Fourth Amendment, to the Fifth Amendment, and because of inaction both by the courts and the Congress, they have been getting away with it. And today there is not much left of our Constitution.
Now, I just want for our listeners, and we're going to talk about the First Amendment, because what's going on in this case is an American citizen wants to publish information as a whistleblower. The rules and regulations and laws gave the FBI 30 days to review it and clear it. They made Sabell sign a contract that said 30 days, an illegal contract, but still said 30 days. And the FBI is sitting back and saying, you, and it's right in this letter that we're looking at, you do not have approval to publish the manuscript, period. In other words, they're threatening her. They're threatening her. And we know what has happened with other whistleblowers who've been harshly treated by the government. They're threatening her by saying, if you publish this, if you go forward, we will retaliate. And let's see. I have in front of me a Supreme Court decision, the Pentagon Papers case, which is the premier decision about the power of the government to do pre-publication clearance or to censor whistleblower disclosures before the American people have an opportunity to learn about them. Here's what the justices said in a variety of concurring opinions in that case, New York Times, the U.S., I'm going to quote here, quote, secrecy in government is fundamentally anti-democratic, perpetuating bureaucratic eras. Open debate and discussion of public issues are vital to our national health. Sabell, did you witness bureaucratic eras or worse when you worked at the FBI? And do you believe that bringing those to the attention of the American people is, in the words of our Supreme Court, vital to the national health?
Absolutely. National health, national security, absolutely. And as I have said in the past 10 years, without the government classification and illegal classification and gag orders, and with a functioning democracy, if my case were to come out, you would see many people being held accountable and actually being incarcerated.
Now, I'm going to read you another quote from New York Times v. U.S., again, setting the standards for pre-publication clearance and the power of the government to suppress speech before the American people can even hear it. Here's another quote. the dominant purpose of the First Amendment was to prohibit the widespread practice of governmental suppression of embarrassing information. And again, Sibel, what do you think in terms of what you want to publish? Does it fit that definition? Might members of the government find your disclosures embarrassing?
I believe this will be one of the biggest embarrassing documented book case out there as far as our governmental people who have abused their positions within the government and have conducted and committed crime will be exposed, yes.
And again, so what we see developing in this case is a direct collision between the dominant purpose of the First Amendment and the government's desire to suppress embarrassing information from being released. And we're looking at almost this is a collision that's going to happen. The government has gone after Sibel in the past. I'm assuming they'll come after her in the future, because part of the harassment against whistleblowers is not just to silence any one whistleblower, but to scare others. And in that context, Bell, once your case came forward, did you work with other national security whistleblowers? And can you tell us what you witnessed, not just among your, but, you know, what happened to you, but what you were witnessing in other national security departments in the country and to those employees?
This exact same pattern, in a way, it was really appalling that it was as if the government follows and has been following this blueprint. It's like this manual that has been given to the heads of these agencies to say, these are the steps you take with the government whistleblowers. And let's say step 1 through 2030, you know, whether it is demoting them, removing their security clearance, leaking information about them, or make up embarrassing information about them, threatening them, having them followed, secrecy. Well, you go through this, and it's like this ingredients, this recipe for food. It's the recipe for whistleblowers. And it's very consistent, whether it's the CIA or the Pentagon or the State Department or the DOJ, they have this manual, this illegal, unconstitutional manual created, and they are following the same exact steps to the T when it comes to government whistleblowers. And unfortunately, with very few, one or two whistleblowers, they are getting away from it. And what we want is, we want to have thousands of whistleblowers, because that's when we'll see they cannot do it to thousands of whistleblowers. Sure, they can single out one or two or three or five, but thousands, and that's what we want, because whistleblowing should not be an exception to the rule. Whistleblowing should be the common practice to keep the government honest.
Well, Sibel, you said it beautifully. I want to thank you so much for appearing on the show. I also want, and I know you have a web page. Can you let our listeners know, like, your website and blog site so they can directly access your information?
Absolutely. Please visit boilingfrogspost.com, boilingfrogspost.com for the latest on this case. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you, everyone, for listening in. Until next week, this is Steve Cohn. Thanks for listening.
And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground. And I won't back down.
The National Whistleblower Center thanks you for listening to Honesty Without Fear, the Whistleblowers Radio Hour on Progressive Radio Network. We hope that you enjoyed the show. Please visit us online at www.whistleblowersradio.org. You can find out about next week's show and submit your questions. Support Honesty Without Fear by making a donation at www.whistleblowersradio.org. Join us again next Tuesday at 1 p.m.
I know what's right. I got just one.